Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. We're going to be talking about another difficult subject. This time we're going to be talking about the Colombian drug trade and how the United States actually started it, which there's a lot of information to show that. You know, Colombia was a very peaceful country before this whole thing took off. They had maybe two murders a year, and those were complete scandals. So I'm bringing on Nicholas Sasuk, and his family was the largest maritime shipping company out of Colombia before the drug trade and after the drug trade. And this is an inside account of how his family had to deal with the drug and the border agents and the CIA and our country and what happened and how it ultimately destroyed his family's business and how it turned Colombia into a nightmare. And we'll hear inside accounts about what actually happened and his belief on who started the drug trade and how it affected our country as well as Colombia and all of Latin America. Very interesting topic. If you haven't heard about the drug trade in depth before, this is an eye-opener. And for those who have, very interesting to hear it from an actual family member who lived it, who saw it firsthand and saw how his family was destroyed by our government and by the drug trade. But before we get into that interview, I want to give a big shout out to my patrons and thank you so much for supporting the program. It's really difficult to keep this thing going without some support from you. So thank you so much. And I want to tell everybody that there will be additional content on this video as well. Nick stays around and answers a couple more questions on the occult and what's behind the drug trade. Very interesting discussion on that. So if you are a patron, go to sarahwestall.com and you'll be able to get that information as well. My patrons I have two books up there and starting to have a collection of videos. And for those that don't have that money, it's not that much money. It's only $1 a month. So hopefully you can afford that. If not, give me a shout out and I will send you my books for free. And hopefully you'll at least get that. So let's get into that interview now with Nicholas Zazu.
Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hey, hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing very good. And I'm glad that you decided to come onto the show and really give the background of your family's business and what happened. It's really an amazing story that really brings in a lot of elements of the drug business and the drug trafficking. But let's start with describing what your business or what your family's business was. Your family was the largest maritime shipping company in Colombia and had built a very successful business before the drug cartels took over. And actually you were kind of got part of that whole takeover process. Can you explain what your family business actually did?
Yes. My father, I'll start at the beginning, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. That's great.
My dad was abandoned by his father, my grandmother, and my uncle were abandoned by my grandfather. And so my dad had to find subsistence for the family. And at the age of about 11 years old, he got on board a boat that would ply the coastal area of the Caribbean coastal area of Colombia between Cartagena and the other ports along the coast south of there. By the age of 21, this is 1930. My father was born in 1926, so this is 1937. So by the age of 21, he was the captain of the ship. By 25, he stopped drinking and smoking and bought his first ship, partying. And so we're talking about 1951. These ships would, transport, anything from people to wood. Wood was a big business. 70s, we had built the largest maritime shipping company in Colombia. Our largest ship was bought in 1973 in Germany. It was $2 million, half of which was financed by a consortium of banks, including Chase Manhattan Bank. I guess that sets the stage.
Okay, well, so you were the largest Colombian shipping company at the time, and you were very well respected, your family. Your father got a lot of different accolades and things. Can you share a little bit of that, just so people understand, you know, how prominent your family was in Colombia at the time?
Yeah, there was a study, somebody did a study, I don't remember why it was or what. I remember when I was a kid, and there was 12 Mercedes-Benz. This is before the Mercedes-Benz became mass manufactured, when they were still done by hand back in the 70s and the 80s. And there were 12 Mercedes-Benz in Colombia, and we actually owned two of them. So yes, we were pretty well off. My father was the president of, I guess it would be the equivalent of Major League Baseball. Down there was called the National Baseball Federation. Actually, he was the president of the federation, not the national one, but the regional one for the state or the department of Bolívar, which is Cartagena, is the capital of Bolívar. He owned three professional baseball teams. In 1975, the Danish government offered him the consul position in our hometown. By that time, we had moved to the largest industrial city of the Caribbean coast of Colombia, which is Barranquilla. It's just an hour north of Cartagena. It's where the Magdalena River, which crisscrosses pretty much half of Colombia, from the mountains, from the capital of Bogota, all the way to the coast. It's where the river meets the sea there. In 1975, he became the Danish consul. And 11 years after that, he was the Danish queen named him, gave him a knighthood. So yeah, we were, you know, among, let's say, the, you know, the top 10, 20, 30 richest families in Colombia, right?
Okay, so you were just doing very well. Did you ever get an opportunity to work on your dad's ship or not?
No, I was born in 1971, I'm 46. So by the time I was growing up, the drug trafficking phenomenon had begun. The war on drugs, you know, had affected Colombia before. It started in the late 70s is when it started in Colombia. So by the time I was becoming an adult, ready to go to university, that's when disaster struck. So no, I didn't get a chance to actually work on my dad's ships, no.
Okay, but you got to see the results of it from a family perspective. So I want you to tell me about that once we get to that part. But now after your family, they were very successful, the largest shipping company. Then the drug cartels came into power and the American CIA trafficking of those drugs started happening. But can you explain what actually happened and how your company's, how your family's company was dragged into this whole underworld of crime?
Right. So my research, over a decade's worth of research, has led me to the following conclusions. The Republican Nixon White House, there were three characters there that were the real power behind Nixon. They were actually the ones who groomed them for political positions. And those people were the Rockefeller family, the Bush family, and specifically Prescott Bush, but George H.W. was the one in the Nixon White House. And Mr. Kissinger. And it turns out that these three characters were the brains or the diabolical brains behind the war on drugs. And at the same time, these same people were the ones who were using the CIA, who had created the CIA. The CIA was a product of Wall Street. And they were using the CIA to create drug cartels in regions of the world where they wanted to have geopolitical influence for whatever reason, whatever reason. In my opinion, they had no business in other people's countries, but, so, for instance, in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, you have drug cartels in Vietnam, in Laos, Cambodia, the Golden Triangle, it was called. For instance, there was a drug trafficker there who sent a letter to the Justice Department telling them that, because he was featured on American television or something like that, where he was selling 800 tons of heroin a year. And so he sent a letter to the Justice Department telling them, well, I sell it to George Bush. So, if you're willing to tell him not to force us to plant the poppies and process the heroin, well, I would be more than glad not to do it. That letter actually exists. That's a true story. I believe it wasn't Vang Po. Vang Po was another drug trafficker that was connected to the CIA. I forgot what his name was, but for people who research this stuff, they'll come across it. So, yes, the CIA has used the drug trafficking to finance paramilitary armies across different regions of the world over decades. But there is a deeper purpose to this drug trafficking phenomenon, this black market, because the main thing about the war on drugs is that people need to keep in mind is that it is the creation of a black market which finances every type of insanity and criminality, everything from neighborhood petty gangs, and you see all the violence that we have in Chicago, all the way to paramilitary armies that cause civil wars, like in Colombia, for instance, where they have displaced 6 million people from their farms. And so the cities in Colombia have become totally unlivable. They're very dangerous. There's dozens of dead people per day. Just a total disaster. The same thing in Mexico, where the body count, the body count in Mexico, I saw statistics the other day where the dead people in Afghanistan and the dead people in Iraq were compared to the dead people in Mexico. The dead people in Mexico is much higher. The body count is much higher. So since these oligarchs, these rich people, these Wall Street bankers, the purpose of this drug trafficking is to destabilize society. It is in order to divide and conquer, to distract people, to create violence so that people look to a central government that becomes powerful and lends itself to control by the wealthy, because if you don't have money, you cannot participate in politics in the way Western democracies have been structured. So it's a total subversion of society. These same families, these same Wall Street bankers were the ones behind Prohibition, the liquor prohibition. And we saw, Al Capone, the violence, the gangs, the same thing. And it will not end until it is legalized. And overnight, we can totally defeat all drug cartels, all of them, all gang violence, all of it can be defeated overnight by legalizing these black markets. Now, kids nowadays can get drugs easier than they can get cigarettes or liquor, because if you have a liquor license that you've paid a quarter of $1 million for, you're not going to sell liquor to an underage kid, you know, because you don't want to lose your liquor license. It's that easy.
Okay, well,
it's really that easy.
Well, let's get back to describing what your family did, and then we can get back to this, because I think people need to understand what your background is so that people can see that you are very, very knowledgeable on this whole black market drug trade and why. And I mean, I think people get the idea of owning the largest shipping company in Colombia at the time. They get the idea. But can you explain how the drug cartels got involved with your family? Because your family wasn't involved at all, and neither was Colombia until this whole thing happened. So can you explain at that time when your family was just doing great, your company was doing great, and then all of a sudden things happened? Can you explain what happened and how your family got dragged into it?
Right. So Colombia had had decades of economic prosperity precisely because this phenomenon of so-called globalization hadn't been invented. It wasn't around. You couldn't bring dollars into Colombia. You couldn't import a lot of stuff. It was totally different. So, all right. Let's see how deep we want to go in this, because there's all kinds of ramifications to why this happened, why the CIA created the drug cartels in Colombia, because the drug cartels in Colombia were created by a couple of people. For example, a man named Theodore Shockley, who was George Bush's right-hand man in the CIA. George Bush himself and Jeb Bush was very involved as well. There was an initial meeting in the port of Buenaventura, at this is in the Pacific coast of Colombia, in, I believe it was 1979 or 1980. And then there was a second meeting in the Intercontinental Hotel in Medellin, where they brought together the biggest 200 biggest drug producers in Colombia, which were, you know, at that time were very small. They weren't big at all. And then, well, they were getting big, and they created the drug cartel with the CIA. I mean, this is a CIA plot to destabilize Colombia in order to spread dollars. And again, the Wall Street bankers have a lot of investments in Colombia, and they've had a lot of, like the Rockefeller family has had a lot of investments in Colombia for a very long time, which I didn't know about. So these drug cartels were able to grow into such a big operation overnight, handling tens of billions of dollars, because they were provided with U.S. military transport for the drugs. All of the drugs were coming in through Panama and then on to the U.S. to military bases in the U.S. Homestead Air Force bases, bases in Texas, all over the place they had operations. Mena, Arkansas, before that it was in Louisiana, New Orleans. And so these drug gangs, they started to destabilize Colombia. But in 1984, when the drug phenomenon was becoming very violent, let me go back one step. We in the maritime shipping business became affected by drug trafficking because our sailors would try to sneak, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kilos of cocaine on board our ship and bring it to the United States because they would make so much money. That's where we first became aware of this. So in 1984, the U.S. Customs Office out of Tampa, Florida, which was one of our regular ports of call, contacted my father and asked him for help on the war on drugs. And specifically, their words were, and this is my mother and my dad told me this, oh, the Colombians are poisoning the youth of America. So, my father said, yes, of course, we will help you, whatever you need. after 3 years of helping the U.S. Customs.
How did you help the U.S. Customs? What did you end up doing?
My father, well, not me, my dad.
Sure, your dad.
My dad, my brothers, my dad and my brothers mainly were the ones who were involved because I was too young. I was 12 or 13 at the time. They would help the U.S. Customs in their drug stings. Like, whenever a drug trafficker would try to put drugs on our ship, my father would tell him, yeah, sure, go ahead, put the drugs on the ship, not a problem, we can make some money. And then as soon as they got to the United States, the U.S. Customs would show up and arrest the drug traffickers and get the drugs. So, you know, in my opinion, it was an unwise decision by my father to do this.
Well, okay, but then, so what ended up happening? Yeah, what ended up happening? Because you thought you were doing a good thing and you were trying to clean up your country and help the United States. But you ended up learning the hard way, or your family did, on what was really going down here. So what ended up happening?
Well, after 3 years of helping the U.S. Customs, even one time at 3 o'clock in the morning, one of the U.S. Customs undercover agents showed up at our doorstep. At our family home in Colombia, with his would-be assassins one step behind him, and my father saved his life. After all of this going on for 3 years, the U.S. Customs agents in one of their drug stings ended up stealing the cocaine and not arresting the drug traffickers. So the drug traffickers showed up at my father's office, and at gunpoint, my father had to pay for the cocaine that the U.S. Customs agents had stolen with a check, because there's a check and there's a letter and this whole thing is documented, and the U.S. Customs will not give me a copy of that letter because I've sent multiple Freedom of Information Act requests to them. And so, you know, they're just total. The U.S. Customs is, I think it's the most, well, probably the DEA, one of the most corrupt agencies. But anyways, so they ended up stealing the cocaine. My father ended up paying for the cocaine at gunpoint. Then they wouldn't arrest the U.S. Customs agents, and they wouldn't pay for the cocaine that my father had stolen, that the U.S. Customs agents had stolen. So, you know, that created a situation where, you know, it was totally horrible. The next thing that happened was, this was in 1986, so the sort of operation with them started with, like, 1984. This incident where they stole the cocaine was, like, in late 1986. And then in the spring of 1987, one of our ships was coming to the U.S., and we had a routine. We had an agreement with the port authorities in Colombia where we could file plans. We would say we were going to Peru, and, you know, to try to shake off the drug traffickers putting drugs on our ships while the ship really was going to the U.S. We had inspections before the ship left. We had, we did everything we could to prevent people from putting drugs on our ship. One of the things we did was that halfway during the voyage, halfway while on our way to the U.S., there was an inspection. And they found some cocaine. So my father gave the order to throw it into the sea because he was upset. He was very upset with the U.S. Customs. I'm sure he was furious with the U.S. Customs by this time. And he just said, throw that thing into the sea and continue on with the voyage. I think the ship was headed somewhere to the U.S. So what happened was that one of the sailors on board the ship must have been in cahoots with the owner of the drugs. And so when the ship returned to Colombia, my father got a call from this senator, this Colombian senator called Luis. And he asked him for an appointment to be able to come to his office. And my father said, yeah, sure, of course. Well, the senator brought along the owner of the drugs. The senator worked with the drug trafficker. So at that meeting, this was April the 7th, the 8th, or the 9th of 1987. It was like a Thursday or a Friday. At that meeting, that man threatened my dad's life. It threatened our lives, our whole family. And that was like Thursday or Friday. And then Sunday night, we always went out to eat on Sunday nights. my dad, my mom, my sister, and I. And at the restaurant where we were eating, the man, the drug trafficker, pulled in behind us and again threatened us. This was in public there. And the next day, we were gone. My sister, my mom, and I were gone to Miami. We left to Colombia. And my dad joined us about a week or 10 days later. 2 weeks later, two months later, my dad tried to sneak back into Colombia. He took a flight from Miami to Bogota.
So you guys moved to, hold on, you guys moved to Miami to escape. You knew your lives were at risk.
Right. We had property in Miami. I was born in Miami. We, you know, yeah, it was one of the places where we always vacationed.
Okay. And so then your dad decided to sneak back into Colombia. Why did he sneak back into Colombia?
Well, because he had to oversee the business.
Okay.
The only person left running the business was my half-brother, and he was a half-wit. And so my dad tried to sneak back into Colombia by going through the capital, not flying straight into Miami. But it turned out, the police investigation found out that the man who used to be the gardener in our home had been paid off to keep an eye out and to let the drug traffickers know if my father showed up. And as soon as he showed up that first night, the drug traffickers broke into our home, tied my dad up, and tortured him for 3 or 4 hours. They would put a gun into his mouth. They would say, you know, feel the cold of death. And they would squeeze his testicles. They wanted the combination for the safe, my mom's safe. And my dad didn't know it. He didn't have anything that safe. It was my mom's, you know, and her jewels or whatever. They took some money that my dad had around because one of our ships was going to cross the Panama Canal. And Noriega, the president, the General Noriega, who was in charge of Panama at that time, wasn't taking checks or something, so he had cash. They took the cash. They took some guns that my father had. I have the newspaper clipping. And so, yeah, they tortured him. And again, my father left to the U.S. And my brother was left in charge of the company, my half-brother.
Well, at some point, George Bush sank your ship. Can you explain what
right.
happened with that?
Right. So by this time, you know, the U.S. Customs agents had always promised my father, you don't have to worry about anything. We will protect you. When this incident started with this drug trafficker, my father, I am sure that he told them what was going on, and I'm sure that he asked for protection, and these people failed to protect him. And the reason why is because they wanted him to get murdered so they could sweep under the rug their crimes. So this whole thing had the potential to blow up in a very ugly way in their faces. Now, at the same time, this is 1987. At the same time, the Iran-Contra scandal was exploding. At the same time, the Christic Institute had filed a federal lawsuit in the U.S. District Court here in Miami, accusing the DEA of drug trafficking. So this whole thing had a chance to snowball into a very big scandal. And again, George Bush was the vice president of the U.S. at the same time. And he was the head of the South Florida Drug Task Force. I call it the South Florida Drug Task Force. But anyway, so on the next, during the next few months, the U.S. Customs contacted my father and asked him if they could put an undercover agent on board one of our ships again, which they had been doing for years. And our ships had the U.S. government transponders, so they could be tracked all through the Caribbean. Anyway, and so my father said, "Yes, of course, you can do it." Well, it turned out what they were after was to smear us, to set a trap for us. Mr. Bush has incarcerated thousands of whistleblowers from the DEA, from the FBI, from Customs. All kinds of people have been put in jail by this man. It is a tactic that they use in order to smear, to discredit people who can do them damage. So what they did was they took the cocaine that the U.S. Customs brought on board the ship, and they put it on the board of the ship, and they intercepted the ship before it arrived in South Florida. I think it was coming to Port Everglades or Miami, here in South Florida. And they took it to the Bahamas under U.S. Coast Guard escort, and they turned it over there, and they accused us of being owners of the cocaine. The cocaine that the U.S. Customs, they had the U.S. government cocaine. So it came out in all the newspapers in the Bahamas that the cocaine belonged to the U.S. government. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on attorney fees, and we won the trial after 2 years. And we were declared innocent. But Mr. Bush gave the order to have the ship sunk, and it's right there in the Bahamas Harbor, in Nassau Harbor. They sunk it.
How did they sink it?
So we lost everything. I don't know. I mean, by that time...
No, not why, but how. There. You don't know how.
No, I don't know how. I mean, I guess they opened up some kind of compartment or something.
How do you know he sunk it? How do you know that George Bush ordered it to be sunk?
Well, I mean, who else would do that?
Okay.
You know, who else would sink our ship except, you know, this insane individual?
Okay, so based on all your evidence, you think it was him that sunk it?
Well, because it had to be him who gave the order to plant the cocaine on the ship and accuse us of being drug traffickers, because nobody else in the U.S. Customs would have had the courage to have given such an order. It could have only come from this criminal mastermind, because remember, this man was the U.S. vice president, but he was also the man who founded the Colombian drug cartels. This man is a true criminal mastermind. You know, nobody else would have had the courage to have given that kind of order.
Okay, so your family ended up losing the business. So when that ship went down, what ended up happening? How did you lose the business completely? And then, well, talk about how you lost the business, and then I want to go into how your brothers and your dad ultimately lost their life.
My brother was chased by drug dealers trying to kill him. My father had several assassination attempts. All of this while they were helping the U.S. Customs, and just because the maritime shipping business just became way too dangerous as a result of this drug trafficking phenomenon. No, my brother's alive. And
okay,
my dad
good.
Passed away, you know, 15 years after all this whole thing happened. So he didn't die as a result of this, thank God.
Okay, good. Okay, I was under the impression they died during this process, but their lives were just threatened continually.
Right. My father, you know, just really got discouraged by the whole thing. He wasn't used to that. You got to understand, you know, in Colombia, you know, folks in America, they've been conditioned by Hollywood to think that Colombia was a very violent place and this and that, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. When I grew up in Barranquilla, this was a city of over a million people, and we had maybe one or two murders a year at the most, and it was a huge scandal if there was a murder, like, you know. It was completely peaceful. It was the drug trafficking that financed and destroyed all of it, the destroyed society. It was, that's what destroyed it. But anyways, my half brother was left in charge of the business in Colombia, and you know, the U.S. Customs wrote a letter in defense of Chiquita, the United Fruit. You know, the people who sell bananas, who bring bananas, and who work with the CIA to topple governments in Central America and in South America for the last 100 years. That's where the term Banana Republic comes from. And so their ships were being caught with tons of cocaine on them in European ports. And so the U.S. Customs wrote a letter saying that it was too dangerous to try to prevent drug dealers from putting drugs on Colombian ships, on ships in Colombian ports. It was just too dangerous, and that was the truth. So, I don't, you know, but I guess my brother, he decided, you know, he was going to do it. He was going to take the money. And so he allowed cocaine to be put on one of the ships. And we know this whole story because the man who gave him $1 million in Miami later told this story to my sister at a party. Like 10 years later, he told her the story. You got to understand that the drug business in Colombia, when it began, it was the upper class of society, the people with money, the people with visas to travel to the United States. They were the ones who got involved in the drug business because they were the only ones who could. He allowed a ton of cocaine to be put on the ship. He was paid $1 million for it. So the next time the ship arrived in the United States, the sailors told the U.S. Customs that they had, you know, what had happened. And the U.S. Customs, instead of investigating and bringing my brother to trial and put him in jail or whatever, my half-brother, he's not even my brother, I never lived with him. You know, to me, he's a piece of garbage. They stole the ship because they have this thing called civil asset forfeiture where the cops, you know, they can take anybody's property without proving, without finding somebody guilty of a crime. And hello, that ship didn't belong to my brother. In fact, half of that ship belonged to my mother. You know, so basically they stole it. These people, and if you look into civil asset forfeiture, you'll see the long list of abuses. And, you know, how this has corrupted law enforcement here in the U.S.
Now, did they want you out of that business anyways because you weren't dirty and they needed the businesses? Okay.
No, my father's broker in Rotterdam, in Holland, he told my dad, you know, hey, our ship, the one that the U.S. Customs had forfeited, is for sale. Do you want me to buy it for you? You know, and my father said, no, you know. I don't want anything more to do with this business, and you know I'm done with it. My father was heartbroken. Like I told you, you got to understand. My father grew up in a country that was completely peaceful, totally peaceful. These assassination attempts, these crazy things, you know, they came much later. They started in the 1980s, and my father wasn't used to that. He wasn't, you know, he didn't grow up around any of that.
So you saw your country be destroyed, and he was. Or go from something very peaceful to something very violent.
Not just the Colombia. I mean, all of Latin America, all of Central America. Like, for instance, I went to Mexico in the 1970s and the early 1980s on vacation with my mom and my dad and my sister, and it was completely peaceful. It was beautiful. It was gorgeous. And now it's a disaster. And not only Colombia and Central and Latin America, but the U.S. itself. I mean, the black neighborhoods, you know, and that's another part of this is another horrible part of this story, because it turns out that the CIA, these Wall Street bankers, they were bringing in the drugs into the black neighborhoods on purpose. In fact, I have the testimony of ex-CIA Colonel Chip Tatum, where he states that the CIA has a plan to, and I quote, get all niggers hooked on crack and put in jail.
So yeah, I have heard that. That's really bad. Okay, now let's go back to the three people you think are behind this, the three families, and why your research has pointed to those three families, Kissinger, Bushes, and who was the third family?
The Rockefellers, yeah. The Bushes, and Mr. Kissinger, yes.
Yeah, the Rockefellers, I'm sorry.
Well, right. Well, because, you know, all the drug money gets laundered on Wall Street. The vast majority of money, the drug money gets laundered. In fact, I believe it was, what was it, the IMF or the United Nations did a study that, you know, if drug money went away, the Wall Street banks would collapse overnight. And it was the only thing that kept them going during the 2008 financial crisis. Well, because it turns out that these people belong to these secret societies, which have been involved in drug trafficking for centuries. There's a book called Dope Incorporated, Dope Inc. And one of the quotes is, the book that drove Henry Kissinger crazy. people are connected to the British Crown, and the British Crown and the British East India Company, and they were behind all the opium trafficking into China 200 years ago, along with something called the Russell Trust out of Boston, and their shipping fleet, the Clippers, you know, sail-powered back then. And they were the ones who created the secret society called Skull and Bones at Yale University. So these people have been drug traffickers for 200 years. I mean, I told you they were behind the liquor trafficking during Prohibition. It's the same people with the same scams.
So they're running both sides. They were running both sides, the war on drugs and creating the drug trafficking.
Exactly. The same Republicans that created the war on drugs were the ones creating that control the drug cartels. Yes, the real drug cartels are the same Republicans who created the black market. Yes.
Well, my understanding is the Clintons are very, very active in the drug trafficking as well.
The Clintons were recruited at Oxford University. They were Rhodes Scholars. And their case officer, the man who gave them orders the whole time for decades, was George Bush. So, I mean, they were always second fiddle. I'm not saying that the Democrats aren't dirty. This goes across the aisle. That both parties are completely dirty. Completely dirty.
So absolutely. Now, do the Rothschilds, does it go up to the Rothschilds? Are the Rothschilds involved at all?
Of course, the Rothschilds are at the head of the whole thing.
Okay, that's what I wanted to understand.
Yeah, listen, the Rothschilds were the ones who controlled the opium trafficking business into China. That's how they made a big chunk of their money, along with a family called the Sassoons. And they are called the Rothschilds of the Orient, the Sassoons. And you will find them in England now. Lord Sassoon, because, you know, even the Queen was involved, so, you know, now they're lords involved in that, yes, of course.
And they specifically use this to make money, to fund their nefarious activities, but also to destabilize communities and countries.
Yes.
That's your understanding?
Yes.
Okay, so... Go ahead.
Just one point. If you would like to get into the occult part of this, what they're doing is they're putting temptation in front of mankind, you know, money and power, to cause violence, to cause people to sin and lose their souls. Because these people worship the devil. That's how they got all their power. It's true.
It's just a weird, just a evil, just incredible stories that I'm hearing over and over again. But you have two federal lawsuits currently going on. Can you explain what these lawsuits are and what your goal for these lawsuits, you know, are as well?
Okay, well, the lawsuits were tossed out in 2014, both of them. The reason why I filed them was because when I started researching this whole thing, because I didn't find out this whole story until I didn't get the whole picture about what happened to my family, you know, the U.S. Customs stealing the cocaine, the whole thing, until about 2013. So at the same time, but I did find out, I knew part of the story, and I knew the corruption, you know, back in 2007, 2008, 2009, and I just became so furious with the whole thing that I said, the heck with this, I'm leaving the U.S. So in 2010, I left the U.S., you know, but two or three years later, I'm following events online, and along comes this group of whistleblowers, these group of CIA whistleblowers, around, you know, congregating around a website called veteranstoday.com. So these people were all ex-CIA, and the things that they were saying were giving me, you know, all the evidence that I needed, all the testimony that I needed in order to be able to bring forth the lawsuit. So when I befriended these folks, you know, they were airing all the dirty laundry, because it turns out that these people are also behind 9/11. So,
you mean the people behind the drug trade, the people behind the
right.
cartels? Okay. Yeah.
Right. They're the same CIA drug traffickers. And it's not just the CIA. I mean, these people, this is connected to the City of London, the bankers in the City of London. And I'm not saying the City of London. I'm talking about the banking district. You know, Barclays, Lloyd's, Royal Bank of Scotland, those people. And these secret societies in Europe. They use the Masons, but specifically the Brotherhood of Death out of Bavaria in Germany. Because it turns out that Mr. Bush, his real name is George Scherf, and he's German. He was born in Germany. And his Prescott Bush was Prescott Scherf. And anyways,
Once
I had all the evidence that these folks were willing to speak out, so I decided, okay, the heck with that. I'll come back and I'll file a lawsuit. So that's exactly what I did during the fall of 2014.
So what was the lawsuit specifically for? What was the claim, and what were you trying to achieve?
Well, I was trying to bring these people down. I completely exposed the whole cabal.
Okay. So you were trying to get compensated for all your losses and show that they planned it and took down our whole company, and it's a big farce.
Here's the thing, Sarah. I it's not compensation for my company or this or that, because the damage has been done. I mean, my family was destroyed, and we were tossed to the winds, and we lost our economic security, our home. We lost everything, and we lost our lives together, and there's no way that can be compensated or brought back.
Mm-hmm.
Only fix them.
Yeah.
So what I wanted was, what I really wanted was for the U.S. courts, the judges, the filthy judges who sit there and self-righteously administer so-called justice. I wanted them to have to eat crow. That's what I wanted. For them to have to sit there and be embarrassed by the whole thing. That's what I really wanted. And not only that, I wanted justice for everybody else. These people have put millions of people in jail for drug trafficking, and it turns out that they're the biggest drug. 95% of all the drugs that have been brought into this country for decades has been brought in by the CIA, the Pentagon, because this goes deeper. It's not just the CIA. It's parts of the military that have been infected with this stuff. And they use the customs, the U.S. Customs, the DEA, as cover, and they're the biggest drug dealers. And I exposed the whole thing.
And meanwhile, they're throwing drug users in prison and wrecking their lives.
And for decades, have you seen what the kind of sentences that they hand out to these people, 20, 30, 50 years? It's insane. And you know why it is? What the whole thing is? It's about slavery. It's about recreating the slave plantations, because the vast majority of the people in those prisons are black and brown. And if you look at the states where this phenomenon is most pronounced, you'll see that it's the South. The South, again, with their slavery and their racism. Sorry,
well,
but that's the truth.
It's so hypocritical, because the people actually doing the drug trading are the ones that are doing the sentencing. So how do you know the judges are so actively involved in the drug trade versus just... Go ahead.
Well, it turns out that one of the things that these CIA whistleblowers brought forth, and specifically Mr. Gordon Duff, who was a CIA colonel at one time, it turns out that these people, this cabal of Bush, Rockefeller, Kissinger, these people, since they controlled the presidency, they have been able to stack the judiciary with judges coming out of something called the Federalist Society. And what the Federalist Society does is it grooms these lawyers to become judges further on. But what it is they're blackmailed. They're either blackmailed homosexuals or blackmailed pedophiles, just like at least 40% to 70% of the U.S. Congresses. And these are figures coming from these whistleblowers. This last figure of 40% to 70% comes from Dr. Preston James, and he got it from the two federal investigations that were undertaken about 20 years ago, and that were able to conclude that easily provable at least 40% of the U.S. Congress are pedophiles. And the reason for this is because these mafias, these secret societies, systematically run entrapment operations against politicians. They take a freshman congressman or senator, and they take them to these parties, and there's a lot of beautiful women, and they give them a couple of drinks, and you know, blah, 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 and then they slip something into their drink, and then the women leave, and they bring in children, and specifically George Bush Sr. brings in the children, and Mr. What's his name, the Netanyahu, that scumbag from Israel, the drug that they slip into the drink is something called scopolamine. It's called the voodoo drug, burundanga, they call it in Colombia. And what it is that when you take this in conjunction with alcohol, you have no idea the things you do. You're very susceptible, you're very suggestible, and you don't remember anything the next day. But these people have it all on camera. So they put them in, you know, it turns out that they were in bed with a little kid, a little boy or a little girl, or some of these politicians are just that perverted that, you know, their sexual preferences run in those ways, and they're not even entrapped. They're just, you know, that's what they like.
Well, because they would prefer to put people like them in power. But how do you know that the Bushes or Netanyahu are the ones giving the children to these people? How do you know that?
Oh, okay. I will read you a little excerpt here from the testimony of a federal agent. This is coming from Mr. Stu Webb. This is StuWebb.com, and you would do well to interview him. He's a 33-year whistleblower. His daughter was stolen from him by George Bush's partner, the head of the Jewish mob, the one who took over from Meyer Lansky. His name was Leonard Milman. So here we go. U.S. senators and congressmen are covering up the dusty Fogel government lobbyist and military prostitution and pedophilia ring in Washington involving legislators, news reporters, military officers, and high government officials. Alberto Gonzalez and President Bush fired San Diego U.S. Attorney Carol Lamb because she was probing the Dusty Fogel Jack Abramoff. Remember him, Jack Abramoff?
Yeah.
D.C. sex ring is child sex and prostitution in exchange for defense contracts and votes for war too explosive for the American people to hear? According to a longtime senior intelligence agent, the Washington, D.C. Hilton, Ritz-Carlton, and Sheraton hotels were used for compromising House and Senate members, national media hosts who had sex with children in a legislative and media blackmail ring. AIPAC, American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, was directly involved with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and GOP Republican convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who provided male and female heterosexual, homosexual, lesbian, bisexual, and child prostitutes sexual services to numerous congressmen, U.S. senators, national media hosts, and other federal officials who were compromised and made susceptible to blackmail at three Washington hotels. The whole Republican and Democratic parties were for sale. The House, the Senate, and the White House. Poppy Bush and Abramoff were up to their eyeballs in this kid shit, said the federal agent.
Wow. Okay, so why were your lawsuits thrown out?
Well, because I didn't know, the part about the Federalist Society, I found out afterwards that the judiciary had been the target of a systematic stacking operation of judgeships And it's logical. It stands to reason. You know, these people control the presidency. Every judge that has been nominated by either Bill Clinton or Bush is completely unfit. I mean, these people are criminals. The Bushes and the Clintons, they're complete. So every judge that they nominated is not fit. So I didn't know at that point that five people before me had tried to expose the CIA in federal court, the CIA drug trafficking. I didn't know that at that time in 2014.
So you were just the sixth one. I mean, there's like a slew of people trying to do the same thing, and you didn't know it at the time.
Let me tell you something else, what I was going to do. I was going to get myself arrested and put in federal prison here in downtown Miami, so I could go and tell everybody in there that was in there for drug trafficking what was really going on, so that we could freeze up the court system, completely bring it to a halt. That was my plan. And the only reason why I couldn't do it was because, you know, they threatened me with, the U.S. attorney threatened me with sending me to a mental hospital. And that's what they do. That's exactly what they did to Stu Webb, as a matter of fact, in the 1980s. Remember, I told you that Bush put thousands of whistleblowers in prison.
Yes.
When he was running for president, after being vice president for 8 years, in order to shut all these people up, that's exactly what they do. So that's what gave me pause, and I didn't do it. But I actually went ahead and I broke the windows at two post offices, and then I called the inspector. You know, the U.S. Postal Service has their own police, and they called Inspector something. And I called them, and I told them that I was the one who had done them. And I wrote a confession. I met with them, and I wrote a confession. I confessed to it, and they were going to take it to the U.S. attorney. And I told them, and at the end of the confession, I wrote, I will continue to break windows at post offices until you arrest me for the destruction of U.S. government property. And that's when they threatened me with putting me in a mental hospital.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that I could see that, because they didn't want you to go to court. So, okay, that's actually a very good, that's a good story and very brave of you. So how can people learn more about you and what you're doing?
Well, I have two websites. One's called usadevils.com, and that website documents the best of these whistleblowers' testimony. You'll have excerpts and then a link to the original website posting, whether it's Veterans Today or Chip Tatum's original website, which he took down afterwards. But and that website also documents my experience, because in 2014, when I ran into these whistleblowers, I was communicating with them through email and then through the radio programs that they were doing back then. I told them, you know, I'll expose the whole thing. I mean, I don't care if these people are trying to kill me. I'm not scared of them. I'm not scared of anybody, to tell you the truth. I'm scared of no man. Because I have faith in God, to tell you the truth, because I don't care what happens to me. After what these people have done to my family, there's nothing left. These people try to murder me, and God saved me, and I had a spiritual experience, because it turns out that these people worship the devil, and good and evil are real spiritual forces, and God is real. So that website documents that, and then the story about my family and U.S. customs and all that, you'll find a link to it on usadevils.com right at the beginning, where I say, who am I? Because folks were, when I first put the website up, they were like, but who are you, you know, with this story? And so I put up the website explaining who I was, and it's kind of long. It's Archangel Michael Help Us .wordpress.com.
Okay. Well, so then we can get people those sites for you. When your life was threatened, how did they threaten your life? Just quickly, we have like a minute left.
No, they spent a year doing witchcraft on me. They did like six assassination attempts. The first one was with a plane. I was at a mine, in a gold mine in Colombia. That's what I did when I left in 2010. I tried to become a gold miner. And they sprayed me with a plane, with a small jet. And I have some kind of skin infection because of what they did. But they also did some other stuff. They have secret weapons. They have energy weapons. They did one where you feel like a claw scratching against your heart, and you hear like some computerized sounds. It's weird. And then during the witchcraft, they can only hurt you if you sin. But they put me in dangerous situations a couple of times with that witchcraft. Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. By the way, at that time, one of the people who, through my email, I used to have a Twitter account. I don't bother with that anymore. But a man named Mark Rockefeller started following me on Twitter. So he wanted me to know that it was him that was after me.
Interesting. Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, your family story, the hardship that you ended up going through. I'm hearing these things from all over the place. So to get somebody who is so close to the situation and is just a wonderful way for people to hear and learn about it. So thank you so much. And I hope you have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, Sarah. You have a great weekend. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you much.
God bless.
Okay, hold on. Oh, okay.